Hey, Starburns listeners, Ben Schwartz here, and I'm here to plug. Here I go. I am in a new movie with Noelle Wells on Netflix. It is called Happy Anniversary. It is out right now. All you have to do is basically go on your computer or whatever device you want. You just click on it, and there we are. It's me. It's Noelle Wells, and it's the story of a couple on their three-year anniversary. They wake up, and on that moment, Noelle's character is done. She feels like she doesn't think she can take any more of the relationship. And throughout the course of the movie, which takes place in over the course of 24 hours, you flash back to all the good, the bad, everything that encompasses this relationship to try to find out if these two actually will stay together or if they won't stay together. It's right now. It is a romantic comedy. Me and Noelle Wells, written and directed by Jared Stern. Netflix, Happy Anniversary, Starburns, lots of words, ending with exclamation. When's it gonna end? It just did. Another tag, and now it's done.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to My Opening Line. I'm Keith and the Girls, Keith Malley.
And I'm Chemda.
My opening line is about people's embarrassing first times on stage. I'm very excited about today's guest. Also, before we begin, let me mention this. Are you using the Laughable app? It's a free app, a free service. Go to laughable.com. You, of course, can subscribe to different podcasts. But what's beautiful about this, you subscribe also to the artist.
So if you love someone but they don't host a podcast, you can actually follow them. And when they're guests on other people's podcasts, you'll get a little alarm if you press the alarm button.
That episode comes into your app. They can't escape you. Great for stalkers. It's perfect for everybody. All right. Ladies and gentlemen, today's guest from MTV's The State and the huge podcast, Risk, Kevin Allison.
Hello.
Hello there.
Howdy.
Kevin, what came first, sketch comedy with the guys from The State or the TV show The State? Being live or being on TV?
Oh, definitely live. We all met at NYU.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. When I got to NYU, I moved to New York for two reasons. To go to film school at NYU because I was like, I want to be a movie director before I realized that they don't like ladies or gay guys to be directors in 1988. There was a lot of sexism at NYU.
Can't be.
But anyway, when I showed up, I wanted to go to film school and to have gay sex. Like, that was the idea of getting out of Ohio and coming to New York. So my first week at school, I was walking down the hallway and I saw Joe Latrullio.
Okay.
And I was just like, holy shit, is he hot? I just thought Joe was so hot. He was from Fort Lauderdale. And it was, you know, Miami Vice was still on TV at that time, around about 1988. And he was dressed just like that.
Oh, my God.
And I was just like, oh, my God. I don't know. It just totally did something to me. So
the guys that were able to wear the Miami Vice thing, now, obviously, everybody was able to wear it. But the guys that cruised around in it. Wow, that's confidence.
It's weird. It's so funny when you see guys who are like...
Yes, you're still getting giddy over it.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's something about a straight guy wearing like... Where you're like, what the fuck are you wearing that peach thing? There's something adorable about it. Or those parachute pants and all. So, yeah. So I was smitten with him and I was like, all I know is... I want to get into classes with that boy. So I was stalking him. I literally waited till drop ad day and was hanging around the hallway to see when if Joe Latrullio was going to be going into drop ad something. And he did. I waited outside and listened to the counselor. And he was going into this class called Motion, Matter, and Meaning. So I was like, okay, so I'll drop one of my classes and add Motion, Matter, and Meaning. So
do you remember what you dropped for him? Trow.
I wish.
No, probably, you know, I was also at that time thinking, well, maybe I'll study comparative religion. And my mother was horrified at the idea because very Catholic. So I probably dropped Hinduism.
Okay. What a different life you would have led.
If it weren't for the Miami Vice pants.
Hold on one second. Are you homosexual?
Well, the twist is Joe wasn't. I soon learned in Motion. His very first movie was all about his girlfriend. Mm. And I was like, oh, okay, so I screwed that up.
And my college career. And $40,000.
But then one day Joe comes into class and he's like, hey, this is a few months into us being at NYU. He says, hey, my comedy group is doing a show tonight. We're called The New Group and we're a brand new. It's our very first show ever. So everyone should come. I was like, I want to see Joe.
I want to come.
Yeah. So I went to this comedy show and it was, and this is an interesting, like, because we did this episode called Remembering the State, where everyone in the state remembers what it was like back then.
On the podcast.
Yeah, on Risk, on my show. But there's also a book, I forget what the name of the book is, but it's an oral history of the whole of everyone in the state. And everyone agrees that that night was magic. There was something about the energy of the group that night that was incredibly palpable in the room. There was probably only 50 people in the audience because it was a little like black box theater.
It's a decent amount.
Yeah. But there was just a feeling amongst the audience that we were watching something classic, like watching Monty Python or something like that. And on the stage, you could tell that everyone felt like, holy shit, this is really special. We've really got some chemistry here. So I walked away from that show with my friends. I didn't really have many friends yet. I had a hard time making friends in my freshman year because I had a really hard time coming out. And when I say coming out, I don't necessarily mean as gay, but as the various sides of my person. I always had a hard time. There's a part of me that's very friendly and polite and Catholic and from Ohio and nice. And then there's a part of me that's ridiculous and absurd and raunchy and kinky and gay and yada. So
New York will definitely help you maneuver through
that. Yes. So I wasn't yet able to deal with that Jekyll and Hyde side of myself so well. So I'm walking away from this comedy show with my friends who know me as bland, boring Kevin from Ohio. And I say, whatever I do, I'm going to get into that comedy group. And my friend said, you? So I was like, fuck that. That even inspired me more. I was like,
that's
fuck
so funny.
That.
It seems very Catholic because Keith grew up Catholic also. And my mom met him. Now, people who know Keith from Keith and the Girl, he's very boisterous and obnoxious. You know, in the last Keith and the Girl episode you were on, you showed us your penis in the middle of the episode. And my mom met him and he puts on the polite Catholic blah, blah, blah. And she goes, what does he do? And I'm like, he's a comic. And she goes, not him.
Just tell me, sweetheart.
What does he do?
There's a winning formula. There's a good boy thing that a lot of, you know, Catholic kids will learn. Yeah. So what I did was I was like, okay, I stalked Joe. Now I'm going to stalk this comedy group. And I started like dropping, adding into all of their classes.
Good news, I speak German.
So everyone was just like, yeah, we all know this guy, this redhead guy. And there was one night.
Are you sure you're in my class? Oh, I'm sure. I'm in all your classes.
I know. I literally did think at one point they must be wondering, like, he does seem to know all of us.
NYU is pretty big.
Yeah. Exactly. So anyway, there was one night when the whole group was going out to this bar called The Dugout, which doesn't exist anymore, in the East Village. It was kind of a punk rock sort of bar, which is strange that it would be called The Dugout.
Well, I'm pretty sure everything in the East Village at that time was rock and roll,
dirty, fucked up. It was like pitchers of beer for almost nothing, you know? And yeah, it was a real mess in there. And so the group is in there and I'm like trying to hang out with everybody. And
now, were you invited or were you like, where are they going?
I think I was invited at that point because I was on the film crew of a couple of the guys in our sophomore class.
They had earlier seen me go through their garbage in their dorm. They just found it easier to let me into their lives.
So I had a Jekyll and Hyde thing from high school, which is that in high school, when I was in the theater production of Bye Bye Birdie in my freshman year, I had a really hard time convincing everyone I wasn't just a bland, boring, regular guy until the first cast party when I got drunk for the first time. I got a bottle of Reunity.
wine, right? Red wine?
Yeah, yeah.
Riuniti, so fine. Riuniti on ice. Riuniti, Riuniti.
Oh, shit. I drank this Riuniti, took off all my clothes, ran around. I was screaming, get the man. I like got the mayonnaise out of the fridge and was acting like it was a game. Get the mayonnaise. And I fell over a banister, deliberately fell over a banister to do a Buster Keaton fall over, you know, into this from the second floor to the first.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I told everyone.
He's like, then I started watching Buster Keaton again. They never show him land.
Oh my God.
So yeah. So everyone in high school said, there's Kevin and there's Freddie Fuckoff. Freddie Fuckoff was what I called myself when I drank a lot and acted like a lunatic. So I knew that I could probably do this with the state, too. Hold on.
Is that what you called yourself? Or did they call you that?
Well, no, Freddie was the character I was playing in Bye Bye Birdie who, like, had one line. It was like, the train's a coming or something, you know, something like that.
You are so creative.
Okay, so we're all at the dugout. Everyone in the state is there. I was the only person there who wasn't actually a member of the comedy group. Or maybe Tom Lennon was too, actually, because Tom Lennon was trying to get, you know, finagle his way into the group as well, actually. But he did so by sheer talent.
He didn't change all his classes and say that he had bed bugs to move closer to the boys.
Yeah, he did so with like writing and acting.
He's so old school.
So anyway, I was like, I've got to do something crazy. So we're all getting very, very drunk, and I go into the bathroom.
I find out they have mayonnaise.
And no, there was no mayonnaise, but there was about an inch of like pee water in the bathroom of this place, right? Because it was such a mess and the toilet had overflown. And I was like, I'm going to take off all my clothes.
No.
And I did leave on managed to keep on my Doc Martens. Okay. So took off all my clothes and raised a pint of beer and came out of the bar. And I improvised this song.
A song?
Yeah.
I'm expecting, is there a draft?
It was
a song.
It was a wailing. It was a fake wailing song. And everyone loved it so much that we remember the lyrics. It was this. I'll remember as much as I can. It was, oh, standing in an inch of urine well becomes the sailing man. Oh, give me that ham sandwich. Put your molars on my hand. Do me like a cauliflower. And then it went on like that. The ham sandwich part, I think, is wrong.
And they stood up, cheered, not only made me president of the comedy, they said, please change our name. What should our new name be so that you feel included?
Well, it was very close. Like, I walked around the whole bar like this.
And you're naked except for Docs.
And I'm naked except for Docs. And this is like in a, you know, in the East Village in a regular bar. And everyone was like, oh my God, this is hilarious. What's going on? And of course, you know, it's 1988. Like, no one calls the police or anything. Everyone's like, that was great.
You know? Performance art.
Right. So I put on my clothes back on in the bathroom. And when I sit back down at the table, Carrie Kenny said to me, you are fucking crazy. You should hang out with us more often. So I knew that was kind of that I had basically auditioned, you know, that I had kind of like,
I have to say, this is the weirdest opening line. Thank you so much. Our 10th episode, definitely the weirdest time on quote stage.
So I became the group's, we used to have, well, it's probably offensive now to call it this, but we had what they used to call a ghetto blaster, boom box, right? And so all the musical cues were on cassette tapes for the group's, you know, show. And so it was my job now, all of a sudden, to be the guy who presses play when AC/DC Back in Black is supposed to come on, or the Humpty Dance, or whatever it was that was going to take us out of a sketch. Until finally the group was like, you know, that whole fucking, you know, standing in an inch of urine thing is so fucking funny. let's just have Kevin do that in a sketch, you know? So there was this totally surreal sketch the group had written, very Alice in Wonderland-y, where no one's making it. It was called Bob, Sparky, and Verbal. And Bob and Sparky keep arguing about, when is Verbal going to show up? When is Verbal going to show up? And finally, I, with like a pink parasol, like, you know, twirling like a French umbrella and wearing nothing else except for Doc Martens, just come across the stage singing my little song about Do Me Like a Cauliflower. But here's the thing. Here's the thing. When that show, well, I don't remember what, I think, I can't remember what theater, because back then, there was no UCB. There was no The Pit. If you wanted to do a show,
you take off your clothes in a bar and you start singing.
No, you had to rent the fucking theater. So the state used to have to put all our money together, which we didn't have, borrow money from our parents, rent theaters, and put on these little shows. Because NYU didn't want, threw us out.
What?
They didn't want us performing there anymore because we weren't an official club that would accept new members each year. You know.
Meanwhile, Gigi Allen gets paid extra.
Right, right.
That's true. Right.
So anyway, my parents happened to be coming to New York City the weekend that I was going to premiere on stage with the state. And I had been talking and talking and talking and talking about how much I love this group of people. I'm obsessed. Oh. I think that I'm going to become a part of this group of people. And one day we're going to be famous and yada, yada, yada.
They care for me. They look out for me.
Right. They
how is it called the state at that point? Is it?
No, it was called the new group at that point because we were the new group on campus.
Okay.
I told my parents that weekend, I was like, oh my God, when I realized what the group wanted me to do in the show, because they had told me, we're going to give you something to do in the show. So I told my parents, you're going to be able to see me in this show. And then when it was time, I was like, I told my parents, you know, I'm so proud of this group and I'm so not proud of this show. It's still such a work in progress that I would hate for you guys to see, you know, it feels more like a dress rehearsal at this point and I would just hate for you to see it. And there's clear, what I've learned over the years is there's a part of my parents that's able to be in denial about stuff when you say something like that, where they're like, oh, okay. You know, when they can sense that, yeah, I don't want you to see this.
Well, here, we keep forgetting that they're people. Not only are they people, they've lived more than us. It doesn't matter if they're Catholic.
Yeah.
They're human beings. And when they say, oh, why didn't work out, Keith, with you and that new girl you were on a date with? I'm like, do you really want to know? Yeah. Sexual chemistry in bed. I don't know what that means. Anyway, how's the weather over there?
When you don't know
what something means, you ask me again in a different way.
Exactly. That is so on the nose. Yeah. So my parents didn't see it that night, but that was the beginning of me being in state stuff. Like they would invite me to, well, have you written anything? So they started inviting me to pitch meetings, and eventually Michael Ian Black invited me to be a part of the group. And this is so funny. He had the persona of being the snarky asshole, which he still has on TV. But back then he was kind of living into it. And it's fascinating to see how some people over the years really change in their personal lives, because Michael Ian Black is like one of the sweetest, most caring, most generous, you know, loving people that I know as far as in the entertainment world. But back then, we really felt like he was a snarky asshole, you know, but he was learning how to communicate with people, and the way he was communicating best was as his comedic persona. Right. So
do you think that they became these personas the way Andrew Dice Clay couldn't be a normal person now if he wanted to?
Well, to an extent, I mean, because there are other people that I know, including comedians, some people in the state who were a little bit assholy and like got assholier over the years. You know what I mean? Or just in the intensity of certain personality traits increased in the same direction rather than in a different one, you know? And I'm sure that's true for me too. You know, I'm sure there are.
It hurts to have clothes on.
Yeah, right.
By the way, how did that first sketch go? How repeating
oh,
that.
Oh, it was a hit. Like, people thought it was hilarious. No one knew what the hell that whole sketch was about. But people thought it was really funny to see me, you know, dancing across the stage naked. No one knew what I was singing about, of course, because I was singing about nonsense.
Did you like it?
Oh, God, yeah. I was thrilled. I was thrilled because I loved the group. I was so inspired by the group. And I felt like there really was a chemistry there that was very hard to put your finger on, but there was definitely something dynamic happening in the group. So I loved that they thought that this weirdo with this different kind of energy could fit into the group as kind of like the gay guy who's from another universe, who is very much about nonsense and absurdity, you know?
And so how did you guys eventually got on TV? What was the first time on TV like?
Well, the first...
Were you naked also?
Well, we all ended up naked at some point, basically, in various sketches.
Well, comedy.
We did our best of show for... with David Wayne and some others were able to finagle because they had done some interning at MTV and for Letterman. So they were able to get the attention of some executives at ABC and MTV to come to a best of show of everything the state had done in our whole college career. So this was shortly after we graduated. And we did that show. Oh, and yeah, I was kind of naked in that show too, because there was a sketch we used to do called Medication where I am naked except for an umbilical cord coming out of my belly button and I'm born out of a table. I was also covered in Queen Helene hair gel to make me look like all gloopy,
God,
like a baby. Yeah. And I even shaved my head for it. Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah. I'll never forget. So I'm wearing a pink triangle because everyone was at that time. I had a leather jacket because my brother had thrown it away as a hand-me-down. So shaved head, pink triangle, black leather jacket. Someone sees me walking in Tompkins Square Park and just, I don't know, he noticed some sort of like, I don't know, Nazi something or other happening with me and everything he was looking at. And he offered me a $20 bill. He was like, here, I want you to have this. And I said, what? And he said, well, you're against the Jews, aren't you?
Oh, my God.
And I was just like, no one walked away. And everyone I talked to afterwards, the state, were like, you should have just taken the guy's 20. I mean,
taking 20 from Hitler, that's 20 Hitler doesn't have.
Oh, my God.
So anyway, that was total tangent. We did our best of show and the MTV folks really liked it. And the ABC folks were like, we would like Ken Marino, period. Oh. And so we went through this weird period of they were offering him $50,000 to be on hold for a year to be in some ABC project. And he turned it down in order to stay in the group because we were like, no, this group has a chemistry. We've got to stay together. So, yeah, so the first show we did for MTV was with Jon Stewart called You Wrote It, You Watch It. It was us and various little comedy groups and or filmmaking teams kind of like making comedic recreations of letters people would write in about funny experiences they had. And the state's sketches were so much better than anyone else. John was the host.
How did you guys decide to call it the state at this point?
Oh, we hadn't yet. Or had we? I don't know if we were the state at the time that we were. I guess we were.
Was that MTV's influence in general?
Yeah. They and our managers decided, no, you guys should come up with a. So we there's a huge list of names that we still have. We didn't call ourselves Medium Head Boy.
Is that what you were rooting for?
Is the state short for something like state of crazy?
It was literally like someone was looking at a newspaper and it was called the State Union newspaper or something like that. And it was like, let's just go with this. And
otherwise it was going to be 75 cents is the name.
Yeah, well, One of them was...
This Week in Weather.
Yeah.
One of them, I think, was the Presidents of the United States of America or something like that. But anyway, so yeah, we just decided here's a weird name that doesn't necessarily mean anything, but is kind of interesting. And what we convinced ourselves of is if you're good enough, then people will eventually just accept whatever the fuck you're called, like Monty Python, you know? So the first, but what happened was you wrote it, you watch it, tanked after 13 episodes. No one watched it. And so they decided to give John his own show, the John Stewart Show, and the state our own show.
That is so funny, though.
Yeah.
You know, we know that the two of you cannot work together. So we lost a lot of money on you. We're going to separate you.
And you double down.
Own show, and now John won't ruin your flow. Your sketches won't ruin John Stewart.
You know, it was so funny because at that time, I always used to think to myself, it's so screwed up that I have two totally separate circles of friends. All my gay male friends and all my comedian friends. So it was Valentine's Day one year. And I decided to have a Valentine's Day party. And what I did is I took all my porno magazines, and I had a lot, and I carved out all the anuses into heart shapes and put them up all over the walls so that you had to get kind of close and look and be like, oh, yeah, that's an orifice there in that little heart shape.
And I forgot my parents were visiting. And I said, I'm proud of my apartment, but I'm also not proud of my apartment.
It's in a dress rehearsal stage. So, no, I invited everyone I knew to this party. All of my gay male friends showed up, and none of my comedian friends showed up except for John Stewart. Who walked in with, like, someone else, a friend of his, and just, like, was like, where the fuck am I? These are all men here, and are these anuses on the wall?
At a Nazi party, and John's Jewish, so it's very scary for him.
So anyway, the TV show, you know, I would say probably I was very, very nervous when we started off shooting remote sketches, you know, like stuff off where you're on location. The very first sketch we shot for the real state MTV show that I was in was this sketch called Sign, where two guys are looking at a sign, a roadside sign, and it shows a sign tilting like this.
Okay. He just described tilting, by the way, like this, and then he tilted his arm.
So
you didn't miss anything.
I think the sign might have said beware or something like that, and then showed the image of itself tilting.
Okay.
And so me and Todd are two guys are like, I wonder what that sign means. And then the sign hits us over the head, right? It tilts itself.
How high
and
were you
smacks
all?
My God. We regularly get stoned for writing sessions.
Right.
We would all write titles, put them in a hat, get stoned, then you pull a title out and you've got 20 minutes to write a sketch. And the thing about sketches is it's fun. It's great to come up with jokes, separate jokes and little ideas when you're stoned. But to write a sketch with a beginning and a middle and an end, you know, when you're stoned, they usually start to fall off into the guardrails.
And then we were looking for Cheetos and I don't know.
Okay, then it's going to be your turn to find the mail. But then we'll be like, there's bigger problems. Who cares?
So, yeah, no, they had to hit me. And this is the thing is, we're on MTV, but we had no budget. So it was just like when we were in college, we were like, we're going to have to steal most of our props and shit. So we fucking stole a roadside sign, which is a federal crime.
And sad because a couple people did not beware. And guess where that led to?
Yeah, but I love, like, he's acting if there was a budget, MTV would be like, yeah, buy that sign.
We have our eyes on a street sign. Right. How much does the city want to sell
it? Kevin, just fill out the right forms and buy the street sign.
But I'm telling you, they hit me with that sign in the cranium several times. And it really... Because
you didn't do stage comp?
No,
oh my God.
We felt like it would not be funny unless you really saw impact.
Well, here's the thing. And Kevin's defense, he took stage combat at school, initially.
But just because.
Long story short, it didn't work out, you know.
Oh, shit. So that was the beginning of the whole MTV experience. And then after the group broke up, I went through a really, what I call my belly of the whale phase, where, you know, I had a lot of social anxiety and I had a lot of, well, you know, comedians can be mean. I think everyone knows that, the group, the state has a very positive energy in its comedy that comes across, I think, in our fun, childish, silly, absurdist stuff. But the group had, there were 11 of us. And we had an established rule that we were a supposedly egalitarian democracy, but that whoever wrote the sketch got to cast the sketch. And everyone comes into a sketch comedy group with very different talents. There are good actors, good writers. There are some people who are better at just being like coaches and brainstormers and, you know, organizers and stuff like that. So there was this weird unfair advantage that the people who were like incredibly good writers who could just shit stuff out on a daily basis were constantly casting themselves. And then
that wasn't you.
Yeah, that was not me. That was not me. I always compared myself to the stories they have about Mel Brooks on what was the name of it? Your Show of Shows. So that was Sid Caesar, Mel Brooks, Woody Allen, Neil Simon, just like this incredible cast of writers. And they couldn't, they would laugh and laugh and laugh at Mel Brooks sketches and be like, that's awesome. We're not putting that shit on TV though. You know what I mean? Cause it was just too outrageous and weird. And that was what started happening at MTV, was that back when we were on stage and I was like, and then I'll run out naked and singing. Everyone's like, great. But on MTV, I would pitch something and it would be really absurdist and far out and like, wait, what the hell does that even mean? And it would be like, yeah, we can't really do that on TV. And it was even more from the executives at MTV, you know, and us getting in the mindset of, oh, what are they going to like or not like?
Right. So cliques get formed, the group breaks up. Do you have postpartum depression?
Yeah, totally. The day, so we quit MTV.
And at this point, do you guys have money?
No.
No? Was MTV not paying?
They weren't. So they would hire about 6 episodes at a time and then leave us hanging for like 6 months or so. We'd have to go on unemployment. And in the first couple of years of our time on MTV, our unemployment checks were the same as our MTV checks, you know, that like $500 a week sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And we were the writers, the actors, the directors, the producers, the editors. We were doing it all, but they were just paying us.
And the waiters and the garbage collectors.
Right, and the caterers. Yeah.
So you didn't have any money saved up, I assume.
No. So what happened? We quit MTV. We were like, we're too big for, they wanted to offer us 5 more seasons. We were like, no. We're going to network. We talked to CBS. We got a deal where we were going to do 3 holiday specials for them. And then they were going to love it so much. They were going to put us up against Saturday Night Live. Well, we did 1 Halloween special for them. The week that Les Moonves was hired as the new head of CBS, who had told everyone, I plan on totally shaking up this network. And we don't even think he looked at our show. Yeah, we think he was just like, I don't have time to think about that right now. I'm focusing on these big shows I'm doing. So a bunch of kids doing sketch comedy, no, just fire them outright.
Nobody cares what the states are. Everybody has their state and that's all they care about.
Exactly. So the night we found out we were fired, I went back to my tiny, tiny little apartment on Ludlow Street, this little like tenement kind of apartment on Ludlow Street. And I remember laying down on the floor of my apartment.
By the way, that's at the time that you were on Ludlow Street, that's pretty badass.
Oh, God, it was. It was the best area to be living in at that time.
Until you went into the apartment, the bedrooms in the kitchen.
Oh, yes, exactly. The shower was in the middle of the living room. The toilet was in a space where you had to kind of like cram yourself into. Yeah, it was crazy.
Do I really have to go to the bathroom?
Right. Yeah, yeah. There was like an oven in the middle of the room.
This is why on Keith and the Girl, you talk about all the different piss play, because you had to.
Yeah.
You couldn't just use a toilet.
Yeah.
That's how you lisp.
It's much easier to just go in your friend's mouth.
I had one of those apartments, by the way, where literally next to my kitchen sink was my shower, and on the other side of the kitchen sink was a bathroom, and you, there was no other sink. You brushed your teeth in the in the kitchen sink, stuff like that. And we're talking about parents. My mom came to visit, and me, I'm like, you know, 20-something, maybe I'm 23, and I'm like, look at my apartment. I live in the East Village. Like, yeah, my shower's in the living room, but, you know, my mom's got to understand that. I'm young, and it's Manhattan. It costs a lot. She walked in and started crying.
Oh.
Just don't awe me. She can get the fuck out. No. I was like, but mom, she's like, I'll do anything to get you out of this place.
Oh,
like,
my God.
Let's just get you out of this place.
It's funny what you think is great. I stayed at a hostel for a year because I didn't mind it.
Wow.
And I started dating a woman. And then I showed her off the hostel like, look at this. I'm kind of the king of it. Whatever I want on TV, it's understood. It's me. Look at this bathroom, how big it is. She dumped me in 2 days.
I forget his name. Was his
name? Feel like you hacked the system, right?
Yeah.
Taylor something. He was in most of Andy Warhol's movies. He was one of the factory folks, one of Andy Warhol's folks. And he was now an elderly man who lived upstairs. And they had to, the health department had to shovel him out of there.
What?
Yeah, he lived like two floors up above me in that Ludlow Street apartment. And they showed pictures of it in the paper. They were like, crazy old artist, legend from the Warhol days, health department. Like, they showed, like, he was a hoarder and hadn't cleaned his apartment in decades. And it was just piles and piles in this tiny room.
Wow.
And they needed to bring like shovels in to throw it all away.
Where was MTV there? They could have been the first hoarders.
Yeah.
The show.
And I'm sure like there's some memorabilia amongst all that. Right. But anyway, wait. So, okay. So the group breaks up, or CBS is like, you're fired. I go home to my Ludlow Street apartment. I lay on the floor and my body was shaking. Like, I was convulsing from just shock that our career, it looked like, was over.
Isn't it something, and you can't go, hey, MTV. Let's go back to that.
No, that was me. I was imploring the group, let's just go the fuck back to MTV. I mean, they might have taken us back.
I don't think they would have. If it's any consolation, it is funny to see. There was a late night show. The name's not coming to me, but not too long ago on Comedy Central, and it would be weekly. And then they went, this is a success. Let's go 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And it failed.
Yeah.
And so they're like, okay, let's go back to 1 day a week. And they're like, no, that's
right,
it.
Right,
and I'm like, well, why is that it? We were doing great the way it was. I shouldn't have pushed it.
The nightly show, I think that happened too. And that was on FX or FXX or whatever.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so weird. It's like, is it too much of a good thing or something? But I'm actually surprised that the group didn't sort of humble themselves and just ask for asking's sake.
Right. There was a weird attitude that among some of the folks who did write the most,
it's just a stepping stone.
It's, well, no, the attitude of, oh, it's, this has all become too cumbersome, like trying to keep 11 people together when several of us feel like we're more talented and deserve more airtime anyway. So this has become a real bother. And should we even stay together, you know, after CBS? And I was the one who was like, no, we got to keep our spirits up and go on to the next thing and remember the chemistry of the group, et cetera, et cetera. But there was this sinking feeling among the group of, oh, look, we've had several missteps here and it's not worth it. We should go off and do our separate things. So the group started fraying, and I felt, another thing is, during the CBS period, some of the guys decided, let's split. Let's no longer be an egalitarian democracy. Let's split into head writers and quote unquote featured players, so that three of the members of the state were three of the 11 were no longer going to be allowed in the writing meetings, pitching stuff and voting for stuff.
Whoa.
And the other eight. You're whatever.
What are we, Stephen Hawking?
Yeah.
People. There are people.
R.I.P.
The rest were, you know, the head writers, right? So I felt.
That's weird to, like, eight people are the head writers and three people get out.
Yeah.
Okay.
Eight, nine, ten, eleven. Yeah. Hilarious. We totally figured this out. Okay. So anyway, I used to do
the same thing in school, by the way, when the teacher would go, Keith, 6 times 9. I'm like, right.
Well, I remember a teacher telling me when I was in kindergarten, she was like, don't count on your fingers because I know adults who never learned to stop counting on their fingers and still do it to this day. And I remember hearing that and thinking, that's going to be me. And it is. You saw me just now.
You know what? You didn't waste any time. It's fine.
But anyway, so I was pretty hurt and scarred feeling after the group finally officially broke up in 1996. And I decided, oh my God, I'm kind of scared about comedians in general because the group could be so cutthroat and the group was so competitive. I was like, oh gosh, maybe I can just do my own thing, right? And the only thing I knew how to do was sketch comedy. So I started thinking what I should do is do sketches as one person, you know, like if I had to, I could pretend I'm talking, you know, like on the phone to someone else or that kind of thing, you know.
I think that's called stand-up, but okay.
Yeah, well, you know, I had seen Whoopi Goldberg's 1985 Broadway show where she's just like five different characters, one at a time.
Like John Leguizamo.
Yes, like John Lee, mm-hmm. Another one who mm-hmm. was a big inspiration at that time.
That's now just considered a one person show, right?
Yeah. Where you're doing character monologues, basically. So I was trying that, and I'll get to the next. This is the next first time.
Okay.
Oh my God. Okay. There was a place called Luna Lounge.
Yes. Yeah. Good spot.
And I was still living on Ludlow Street. Ooh. It was on Ludlow Street. And at the time, so this is 1996. At the time.
This is, by the way, we've spoken on this show about surf reality. This is like around the corner from
exactly,
there.
Exactly. But there weren't, it was really only like those two places, I think.
And Collective Unconscious.
Okay, I don't even know about that. Where was that?
That was like down the block from you. Used to be, I think, prostitution. Then it burnt down, and then it became this artsy space.
Oh, okay. I think I know what you're talking about. Right.
And those poor prostitutes are like, why can't we just go back to that? And they're like, times change.
Exactly. Les Moonves
right.
took over the operation. There weren't many places where you could do what was then being called alternative comedy. At the time, I think Largo was starting to happen in Los Angeles, but in New York, Luna Lounge was the place on Monday nights. And now, if you look back at those Luna Lounge days, you know, Mark Maron and Stephen Colbert and Amy Poehler and Dave Chappelle and Zach Galifianakis, like all the UCB people, like everyone, Sarah Silverman, everyone was performing there.
See, this always... I always want to tell people, remember this. All the names that you hear now on TV, when you see them at a restaurant serving you as a waiter, you treat them like shit until MTV or Comedy Central calls them gods, and then all of a sudden you'll eat their shit.
Yeah.
So just, I don't know, just keep that in mind. They were funny that whole time.
Yeah. I live my life as if everybody around me can write a book.
Yeah.
You never know what they're going to say.
Because it's like, of course all these guys were at the good open mic or even the shitty open mic. Everybody started in the same place.
Yeah. It was but now to get on to the Luna Lounge show, I forget what it was even called, but it was on Monday nights, and there was an agent from a casting agency that was the guy you had to talk to about getting on the show. And because I was a member of the state, I had someone like Michael Ian Black or something like that ask if I could be on the show. And I booked it one night. And I was like, great, I'm going to do one of my kooky, crazy character monologues. And I wrote this, you know, 10 or 12 minute monologue. And it was...
That's long.
A guy who comes out on stage and he's telling you that he's Charles Manson. And then he's yelling at you for being so stupid that you would think he's Charles Manson.
Is it odd that everything's Nazis about you? What? Everything seems Nazi related.
He's basically schizophrenic. He starts out crying, like, you know, like, why would you think I'm Charles Manson? And he's like, you fucking idiots. Why do you think it? And then he's like, of course I'm fucking Charles Manson. So it was a very hard monologue to memorize because it just bounces through shifts in tones and logic.
You didn't take notes up on stage the first time?
No, here's the thing. I thought, I have so much social anxiety about being around other comedians, and I have so much worry about this first night at Luna Lounge, because the room was always packed as well. Like, people were like growing up the walls like ivy. It was a total fire trap. They didn't even have chairs. People were sitting Indian style in the goddamn place. It was totally...
We call it crisscross applesauce now.
Oh, shit. But anyway, so I decided, here's what'll make me confident. I'm playing a character with a lot of confidence, even though he's crazy, so that'll help me get through it. But also, I'm going to memorize it word for word, over and over and over and over and over again. So I recorded it on my Sony Walkman with Megabass.
Mm-hmm. Nice, bro.
I remember walking like from the Lower East Side up to like around Harlem and back again, just listening over and over and over and over to this monologue.
Plus, you're thinking, if Marlon Brando can do these long monologues in The Godfather, why can't you?
Then, exactly.
Then later you learn that he wrote his lines on people's faces. Oh, I didn't know that.
So the monologue at the end of it's like a 10 paragraph long monologue, right? And at the end of the first paragraph, I'm supposed to look at a member in the audience and say, think about it, jackass. And so I'm performing the monologue and I get to that point. I look at someone and I say, think about it, jackass. And then the entire monologue, I forget. I can't remember what comes next, what this monologue is about. Who am I? Yeah, who am I? Right. And I went numb and blank. And I'm looking at the audience, and they're looking back at me, and everyone's kind of confused as to what's happening.
And you just told them to think about something.
Yeah.
Do you mean literally? Okay, I'm trying, guys.
So I thought, okay, I've memorized this so well that what I should do is just go back to the very beginning of the first paragraph, do it over again, and then it'll all come back to me. So I start the monologue again.
Without saying I'm going to start it?
No, okay. Right. And the monologue begins, hey there, I guess you're wondering who I am. So I'm right back there, and people are like, what the fuck? Now it's like Waiting for Godot, you know, like, okay.
Oh,
we remember this whole first paragraph. So I get to
think about it again.
I do. I get to think about it, jackass, and I go blank again.
Oh my God.
Oh, now, Jeff, what's his name? He does all the, Jeff Ross. Jeff Ross was the host that night. And he was sitting on the stage because the place was so crowded, he couldn't get off of the stage. You know, everyone was sitting crissy crossy.
Right. Very good.
So I'm like, I have to find a way to tell him I can't do this, but not so everyone can't hear.
Oh, my God.
So I turn to him and I just go, I can't do this. And of course, everyone hears because we're all right on top of each other.
And there's a mic in front of me.
Yeah. So I'm like, there's no way for me to get off stage unless, and I go through the, you know, it's about 40 feet away is the door, and I have to walk through the audience to get there, and they're all crazy on the floor.
Do you think for a split second, what if I just start killing people?
it would have fit the Charles Manson thing. So I start tiptoeing over them to try to flee the theater, right? And everyone is like, they know it's alternative comedy, right? So they're like, oh, Kevin is playing a character who is so crazy that he thinks he's Charles Manson. And a guy who's that crazy would also probably randomly try to flee the theater at some point, right?
After going, I can't do this.
That show, The State, was always weird. Okay, okay.
So they start cheering, no, you can do it. Do it, do it, do it. Now, I've got, like, tears forming in my eyes, and I'm like, no, I really can't.
Like, oh, he's really pushing this character.
It was like the actor's nightmare turned up to 11.
I really can't.
Finally, someone grabs one of my feet and I fall into all the people sitting crissy crossy.
This is finally, by the way. Right. Finally, I fell on my face.
Thank God.
I had to go to the hospital, so they had to stop chanting.
Well, it was at the same time that, like, crowd surfing was so popular. So people start to bob me up and down, which is very awkward when everyone's sitting. Like, you're only like 2 or 3 feet above the ground to begin with. So I've got like my ass in someone's face and my hand and my feet kicking people and they're bobbing me around. And I feel like I'm in an Italian horror movie. I fell into the bowels of hell with people throwing me around. And they threw me back onto the stage. They were like, do it, do it, do it.
Whatever it is.
And at this point, I'm like,
take off your clothes. Right. That's what you know.
if only it had occurred to me.
Don't put your dentures on my ham sandwich.
Unzipping.
They're like, he saved it. No. What happened was, it was a dominant and submissive thing. I was like, I have no choice. I am no longer the person calling the shots here. They say I should do it. And something in my psyche was just like, remembered the entire rest of the monologue. And so I delivered.
Did you start over?
No. I went from the thing about a jackass part. And, you know, I was going to paint the walls with their blood because I really was Charles Manson. And no, I wasn't. Blah, blah, blah. And I went through the whole thing and it was great. And it killed. And at the end of the night, people were like giving me high fives. And I ran into the casting director who put the show together. And he was like, you were the fucking best act tonight. And I said, here's how good I am at dealing with industry people. Right. Oh, I was like, you don't understand.
It was real.
No.
I was really trying to flee the theater. He was like, what? He was well, even if you were. You've now faced the worst that you could possibly face, and you came through it great. And I didn't really take that to heart. At the time, I was like, no, that was a scarring nightmare, living through the bad part. Then many years later, around the time that I started doing Risk, I was listening to a Bob Dylan concert that had just been, you know, one of those bootleg things that had been released, where it was like Bob Dylan at the age of 21 and he's at like Lincoln Center, right? So he's young and he's like still just singing folk songs and he's at this suit and tie sort of concert, like at Avery Fisher Hall. And he starts this song and it's a riff that he just keeps doing the same riff on the guitar. And you're like, what? What's going on? Just riff, 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 riff. And finally he says, does anyone out there know how the words to this song go? And someone yells it out. He's like, thank you. And then he starts the song. And I'm like, that's it. Like, that's, you're never totally alone out there. Like, the audience, they want you to succeed. And if you're totally fucking up, there's people to catch you if you fall, literally, you know?
At the end of the concert, you go, hey, I've been there. I know what you were going through.
Whoa.
So that was my first experience doing the character monologues. And I kept doing it for about 12 years, but just was not getting anywhere with it because I continued to be so haunted by stage fright. I continued to be really lazy about not getting up on stage often enough. And I just wasn't socializing enough. You know, I wasn't like as plugged into
the connections.
Yeah. Yeah, I really, like, members of the state were very aware of the fact that I wasn't accepting as many of their invitations to things. They knew that I was hurt and upset about how the group had broken up. And I just didn't handle myself very well during that period, you know? So they stopped inviting me to do things. You know, things like Wet Hot American Summer happened, and almost everyone in the state was involved except for me, you know? And it was mostly because I think they really sensed, wow, God, Kevin's really off on his own and doesn't seem to want to like play anymore, you know? And it was all because of stage fright, laziness, avoidance, you know?
Is that why you called the show Risk?
Well, this is what happened. 12 years later, I finally decided I'm going to give this one final shot. And I'm going to do
it. That's a long time of terrible characters.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And stage fright.
Well,
for 12 years.
There were 4 years in there when I gave up show business entirely. For four and a half or 5 years, I went and tried to become an editor, a book editor and a magazine editor. So I spent time getting fired from a small book publisher, fired from Rolling Stone, fired from Spin, fired from Premiere Magazine.
Impressive.
Yeah. It was a nice little run there of getting fired. But then in 2008, I was like, okay, I'm going to try acting again. I'm going to do characters again. And the show is going to be called F Up, five characters who fucked up their careers. One of the characters, for example, was a Jewish vaudevillian who in the 1920s who had watched his partner from vaudeville go to Hollywood and become famous without him.
What does that sound like?
Yeah, exactly. So all of these, another character was like based on Peter O'Toole during the period where Peter O'Toole would often be too drunk to perform. Right. So these were clearly characters that were kind of based on me. I was trying to be autobiographical with this show in a way that wasn't so blatant as me just being me. So I did this show at the Pit a bunch of times. I did it at Philly, the Fit, a few times. And then I finally did it at San Francisco Sketch Fest in 2008. And that was an awful experience because it was a theater that could seat close to 300 people, I think. And it was almost empty. And the mic wasn't working, so I had to scream the whole show.
What if 300 people showed up?
Yeah, exactly. But Michael Ian Black was there. And after the show, I said to him, what'd you think? I felt terrible about how the show had gone. And he said, Kevin, I feel like I've said this to you before, but I'm going to say it again. I think you should drop the act. Stop it with the characters. Get up on stage and tell your own stories as you. Your life is batshit crazy and people would enjoy listening to you being you. And I said, ugh, but I'm so many things that don't appeal to like Hollywood agents, and I'm so complicated. Like I'm too gay and kinky and raunchy, but at the same time too friendly and Midwestern and polite, and that doesn't make sense. And I'm too serious and intellectual sometimes, but then too absurdist and yada. So I said, it feels too risky. And Michael said, that's the fucking word. If it feels risky, you're doing something right. If it feels risky, then you're probably opening up and an audience will open up to you. So I felt, and I did know that he had said this to me, but he had said it to me way back when we were on MTV. Because back when we were on MTV, there would be those long stretches with the studio audience where the cameras had to be reset up and yada, yada, yada. And we didn't know enough to have hired like a warm-up act. So Black would just get out there and improvise stand-up comedy. And the rest of the group was like, oh, he's such an egomaniac. No, he was learning how to like talk in front of an audience as himself, just off the cuff. He was training himself there, taking an opportunity. So, all right, I'm on the plane back to New York, and I was like, I'm going to be turning 40 soon. This show is not working. I'm terrified of entering my 40s without trying something new and shaking something up. I've got to try something I've never tried before. He threw down the gauntlet with me with that dare. So as soon as I get back to New York, I'm going to tell the riskiest true story I can think of at a storytelling show. I didn't know I knew storytelling shows existed. I had heard of The Moth, but I had never been to one. So I knew that Margot Lightman and Julia Rotzi had a show called Stripped Stories.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was all people just telling stories about sex. And I called Margot because I knew her through some other friend. And I said, I'd like to do your show. And I'd like to tell a story about the first time I prostituted myself. And she was like, great. She's like, that is perfect. And then a couple of days go by and it's the day of the show.
Did it feel good to say that? Or did you start shitting a brick?
Started shitting a brick right there. I was like, I don't know if this is going to work. I don't know if this is a good idea. I don't even know who comes to see her show. You know what the audience is like. It was at UCB Chelsea at that time. So I'm working on this story. And the day of the show, I called her 4 or 5 hours before the show.
Oh, my God.
And I say, just like with Jeff Ross, I was like, I can't do this. I've got to back out. This just feels too risky. And her response, I'll never forget it. She was like,
am I talking to Kevin Allison or Freddie Fuckup?
Exactly. No, she said, that is awesome. And I was like, what? She said, listen, it's not that I don't want you on the show. She said, it's that I want you on the show. It's awesome because the day of the show, there's often someone who calls and says, I don't think I can do this. And that usually means that it's an especially risky story. And if I can convince them to do it, then that's the one that like is the biggest hit of the evening. So I was like, oh, fuck. Okay, you convinced me. So I went to UCB that night and I told the story about the first time I prostituted myself, I've told here before on your show.
On Keith and the Girl.
Yeah.
Had you ever spoken about that to anybody before? So it was the first time you're even talking about it. I love it.
I mean, I'm sure I had talked to some of my gay male friends about it. Yeah. So anyway, I tell the story and what's really interesting about
it. Do you
remember
how you started the story?
Oh gosh, I start the story by talking about how in roundabout when I was 22, I felt totally incompetent and incapable of doing things to take care of myself, to make money. I felt like the only thing I was capable of was sketch comedy, which in retrospect is kind of funny that I start a story about how I've always felt like the only thing I'm capable of doing is sketch comedy. And this was the night that I was going to learn that I could do something else. So I'm telling the story and I noticed that I came to those moments when I would feel like, oh, that sounded too gay. It was the voice. A lot of it was the voice of, I hate to say it, but kind of that super ego voice that's kind of usually a little bit my mom in my head, you know, of, ooh, tone it down with the gayness. Ooh, that was too loud. Ugh, that was kind of too, no one gets that joke, absurdist, you know, that kind of thing. So I would get to those moments in the story and then notice that they were still with me, you know? And eventually, I was really making a connection there and feeling like, oh, the more I just do that, the more I just dare to be weird or too gay or whatever I feel is appropriate in the story, they're more and more with me. And I just felt such a connection. And another thing, so the story went over great. And this, it seemed like mostly like frat guys in the audience that night, which was really funny because it felt like, oh God, everyone looks straight and fratty. And so, you know, I was like, oh my God, I'm terrified of this audience. But they ended up loving that story.
That's so interesting. When we first started Keith and the Girl, it was 13 years ago at this point. And part of the reason why it's called Keith and the Girl is because I didn't want to take the risks that Keith did. And I mean, And quickly, I mean, really quickly, when you start talking and you realize no one's, you know, your crazy shit that you always wanted to kind of keep in the closet or very close friends who you want to make sure would understand you, all that stuff, someone's relating it to it. Several people are relating to it. It takes the edge off of what you thought of it. It makes it like, wait, I'm just a normal person.
Yeah.
These are my, you know, extreme moments maybe, but they're coming from the same place everybody else
is. Oh, totally. Like, you know, there have been people who have shared, like, for example, I'm in the earlier hour, we were talking about how some guy came on Risk and talked about eating shit. Well, people write in, they're like, well, I would never do that. That is not something I want to do. And yet the emotion that that guy described about the intimacy in their relationship and being afraid to cross a boundary and yada, you know, like, even if people have not done that particular thing you're talking about, they can relate to the psychology of it, the feelings and thoughts that you're being frank about,
right, the
start
fear,
to resonate. Yeah.
Fear that you're feeling the excitement.
Right.
Or
so no one in that room had to have prostituted themselves before to understand my story.
And even if you get something different out of it, like I just learned I wouldn't do anything for a love.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Saves your relationship.
Yeah, exactly.
You know what to put in your vows.
Right. And then you realize, hey, this is me.
Yeah. Well, another thing that happened that night was that afterwards, I noticed that people weren't just saying that was funny, like the Manson monologue back at Luna Lounge. People were saying, oh, that was really funny. But they were also saying stuff like, oh my God, that got me thinking about this thing that happened to me when I was in the seventh grade. Or, you know, like I could tell that it like resonated with people more deeply. So I literally walked away, walked down 8th Avenue after that show, walking away from UCB, and was thinking to myself, in the past like 5 days, I've come by this word risk twice with Michael Ian Black and then with Margot Lightman.
I am getting so many chills. Right? Okay. Yeah.
And the whole thing just occurred to me. I was like, there's one thing I'm afraid of doing, and that is getting up on stage on a regular basis. And the other is just putting myself out there regularly. So if I put together a show that forced me to be on stage on a regular basis and then forced me to be putting something out to a wider audience on a regular basis too, gave me a deadline, that might change things for me. So I thought of a show called Risk. And it's funny because people are like, oh, because, you know, the show did start out mostly funny before we started having stuff like murder and child molestation.
I imagine it's because you were surrounded by comedians.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So all the first people I asked to do the show were comedians. But the audience got it. The audience got the podcast right when it started and started contacting me about, oh, I'd like to tell a story about some really traumatic thing that happened to me. But that was how I always envisioned the show, right, from walking down 8th Avenue, was it'll be a show where people can come out about anything. Nothing is too intimate or emotional or funny or horrible or whatever. And that'll be it. And I hate to say this also. Every time I bring up my mom, I'm like, I hate to say this. But I actually felt like creating this show will be the ultimate fuck you to that mom voice in my head saying, don't say that. Don't say that in mixed company. Like, tone it down.
You're saying that you knew that. I thought my mother's voice would be in my head all the time. And as I gave up more about my life on Keith and the Girl, as I told more stories, I became more intimate, I dropped all of that and I slowly took my parents out of my brain going, you know, women don't say that. Nice girls don't do that. You know, hide that because people won't be your friend.
Yeah.
I started going, hey, every time I do the opposite, it makes me feel good. I sincerely connect with people instead of, you know, trying to make believe that I'm a person who I didn't even decide that I wanted to be that person. It was my parents. And so this, the whole storytelling, the whole podcast, I mean, you know, we were doing podcasting before it was on iTunes. Yeah. So it was risky. And so it was such a big deal to me because I became independent. And even though we started when I was an adult, I felt like I became more of myself as an adult because I wasn't scared anymore of what my parents would think I was doing or saying.
Well, see, now that we're doing the Risk book, I'm finally crossing a Rubicon because my mom has never heard the podcast. I mean, I've actually played some, you know, like some of our Christmas stories right. for her, the ones that are like really not very risky, quite frankly. Or a story about when I was devoutly Catholic and I leave out what I am now.
What could you be? I was devoutly Catholic, and now don't worry about it, Mom.
Right. I leave out my new communion.
That is so funny because that was when my fear bubbled up to the top also.
Did you guys?
We got a book deal.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, my mother understands what books. She doesn't understand what podcasting is. So I'm kind of safe. Oh, she works on the internet. Who knows where that is? I called my parents and I said, hey, I have a book. And it's about sex and relationships. Uh-huh. And I didn't want to say all that. And I said, but they're going to see it on Amazon and they're going to see it in place. Their friends might bump into it.
Yeah.
And they just ignored it again.
Did they?
Yes.
I'm wondering if that could happen with my books because
it was fascinating.
They did that with the state book. The oral history of the state came out, I was like, oh my God, I'm sharing some crazy, you know, like, you know, the, you know, getting sucked off by a dwarf after a show and stuff like that in this book.
Little people now.
I'm sorry.
I don't want your story to be dwarfed by that. That's all. I think we're still allowed to use it that way, but I'm not sure. So
okay. But anyway, yeah. So when the state book came out, I said to my parents, I'm not really proud of this book. I think there's some stuff said. It was the exact same thing as, you know, my first time with the state. But with Risk, with the book, I feel like, oh my God, they've heard a lot about Risk and their memories aren't good. So I every time we
they're
talk
so
about
they're so pretending
it,
their memories aren't good. It's funny what they remember from your past. So my parents remember when I laugh awkwardly.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. I'm like, don't you guys remember? I've told you it's incredibly uncensored. There's sex and drugs and all this stuff happening.
This is what your dad does. Every time Keith goes home, his dad goes, what do you do for a living again?
Yeah. What are these podcast things? So now the book's coming out and my mom's like, oh, we're telling all our friends. And the last time I spoke, I said, listen, I don't know. Like, we have to have a conversation about this. I have to take a good look at the book and see how I feel it. But because I think there's even a moment in the book where I say something about that motherly voice in my head, like in the introduction to the book.
That's a place. Like on the front jacket.
I dedicated it to my mother, but no big deal.
And I definitely, because I have a story of my own in the book, which is the first story I ever told on Risk about a time a guy made me tie my shoes to my balls, which I probably told on here too. Yeah. And like most people would see that as just a plain old funny story. That's a harmless story that most people just get a big old kick out of.
Yeah, because I know at the end of the story, you're not going to tie anything to my balls. Like, that's what you did.
But a parent is going to wonder, did I teach him to tie a shoe correctly?
Exactly.
Should I have not had him go from Blue's Clues videos, you know, whatever you had at the time?
Did you, you know, have arches in those things?
The Risk is fantastic, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
And I'm sorry you wasted those 12 years of your life, but I'm glad you figured out what you want to do. And that's what matters. And I do recommend the book as well.
I feel like so at the end of this, we always ask people what their advice would be, but I feel like we kind of organically came up on it, but correct me if I'm wrong, and it's be yourself.
Be yourself and look for, you know, definitely get over the, I'm too social, you know, I have social anxiety, I'm, you know, like, be as connected as you possibly can. Remember that if you're afraid of some people in the business, then there's going to be plenty of other people who are super sweet, you know, like, so just keep searching for making connections, doing stuff. Doing something like a podcast, like that whole deadline thing, you know, make deadlines one way or another to be showing up or putting something out there.
So sort of like make promises and then you have to keep them. Make promises that include other people.
Yeah.
You got to show up.
Yeah. Yeah. And being yourself is a constant challenge too. Like it's not something you just like you do once and then, oh, okay, I figured that out, because there's various layers of, you know, little ways that you're not authentic.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Because even now, this is, again, 13 years later, I'm like, I didn't even know that about myself.
Oh, God.
There's another layer.
There's another thing that I can come clean about, or that I can, like, you know, oh, I'll bet you're wondering about this aspect of me, or here's something I'm still wondering about myself. Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, Kevin, it's always so good to talk to you.
Thank you. This is super fun, guys.
Yeah, I'm just known as being a chronic liar, but that is the truth. I don't know why I said that, but that is the truth. I think you're fantastic, all right?
So wait, pre-order the book at theriskbook.com.
And now the closing theme song. What you just heard was my opening line. Please subscribe and tell your friends. Go to myopeningline.com.
Took a lot of time to compose, I'm sure.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it, and here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right, Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we call clubs discotheques? LOL, the 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome. Not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced ve a pe in Spanish,
oh my God.
He spots his dear friend, who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.
Oh, my